Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, the visit to Utah by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke as part of a review of national monuments ordered by President Donald Trump. Plus, Utah U.S. Representative Jason Chaffetz asks for an investigation into the firing of FBI Director James Comey. And more. And joining me on the phone today is Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Berg. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Roger.
And in studio here at KCPW, we've got Senior Managing Editor, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Welcome to you.
Hello.
Public Lands Reporter Brian Maffley, thanks for being here and welcome.
It's good to be here to do my civic duty, Roger.
All right. Good morning. And columnist Robert Gerke is here as well. Welcome.
Thanks. Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. Consider it your civic duty. Again, that's 801-355-TALK. All right, now that we have primed the pump, gentlemen, let's start with Ryan Zinke's visit to Utah that took place this week. The Bears Ears National Monument was the major focus of this trip, and Brian Maffley, the Interior Secretary, is conducting a review of national monuments. That review was requested by the president, and we'll get to why the president pushed for this review a little bit later. But Zinke spent a few days here this week as part of this review of national monuments. Who did he spend his time with, and what were the messages that he heard?
Yeah, right. Well, it was the review is coming more at the request of Senator Orrin Hatch.
Okay.
And it's a little background. It's 27 monuments that are the large, over 100,000 acres designated since 1996. And that was the year the Grand Staircase was designated and is and was and forever will be very controversial. And he's on a tight, Ryan Zinke's on a tight time frame for the Bears Ears. He has a 45-day window to produce some recommendations. And today is when a public comment period starts for only 15 days. You submit comments on regulation.gov. Okay. And by June 10th, there will be a recommendation. So with that background, the secretary came to Utah on Sunday and met with the Bears Ears Coalition. That's the group of five tribes who proposed the monument in the first place. And then he flew down to San Juan County to check out the monument on the ground. However, this has been dubbed a listening tour, and many of the critics of this review have really kind of pounced on it as a charade. It seems one-sided, and everything I saw kind of backed that criticism up.
Well, and you were traveling, with this delegation, the Interior Secretary and officials with him, and also state officials. And I know that part of that criticism that you're describing comes from the idea that the people who were setting the agenda are those who have a certain degree of antagonism towards national monuments. This is state leaders who want to see them undone.
Yes, not just state leaders, but local county officials, as well as there were a couple interesting political operatives in that entourage, and I had to wonder what were they doing there. But one of them was this guy Matt Anderson, who works for the Sutherland Institute. He told me he was just carrying, you know, Mike Noel's bags out of the airplane. And the other person I was in that entourage was Stan Winters, who's the chairman of a new group called Foundation for Resource Integrated Management, or known as FIRM. And they're a fairly new group that formed and is funded with state money to sue the Department of Interior. And first up on the list is to sue to undo the Bears Ears Monument, which, of course, might all be a moot point if President Trump undoes the monument. So the press was kept at arm's length during that whole trip. I mean, in San Juan County, there were only two opportunities for the press to interact with the secretary. For the most part, they asked us to stay back. We weren't allowed in the airport terminal at the Blanding, for example, nor were Native Americans who were there, who were part of this nonprofit group, Utah Dene Bakea. They were hoping to have a word with Secretary Zinke. That didn't happen.
I wanted this maybe, to me, it doesn't seem all that surprising given the fact that, Utah's leading this effort to try and take control of federal public lands. That's not something that Zinke has been on board with. But,
of course not.
But no. If you're involved in reviewing national monuments, you already... That suggests that you already are on the side of the crowd who wants to see them undone, because a review from the presidential administration means we're challenging what national monuments are.
Yeah, and what they're challenging about it is the size of the monuments. The Antiquities Act of 1906 talks about setting aside areas that are the smallest needed to protect the resources the designation is... has been done for. In the Bears Ears case, it's the tens of thousands of archaeological sites left by the ancestral Puebloans all over Cedar Mesa.
I want to remind just our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. You can call us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Just a quick question. You mentioned that there are, the five tribes in our region who supported this designation, who advocated for it. Did they how much time did they get with the secretary?
Yeah, on Sunday there was an hour-long meeting with members of that coalition. It's the Ute Mountain Ute, Navajo, Zuni, Hopi. And from what I've heard was that they had actually asked the secretary to enlarge the monument. They had originally requested a 1.9 million acre monument. When then President Obama designated it, he left out parts of the west side of Cedar Mesa, White and Red Canyon in particular, that have uranium deposits. I mean, to me, that was proof that he was listening to local concerns when he designated the monument. And the tribes would like those areas put back into the monument. That's one of the things they asked.
Okay. And there are also some regional grassroots, nonprofit, local business groups on the ground there who advocated for this monument, groups like Utah Dene Bekea. They, as I understand from your reporting or other reporting in the Tribune, they had a difficult time getting in front of Zinke themselves, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't from any lack of trying either. They appeared, their board members and other elected chapter leaders, Hank Stevens from the Old Jato chapter, for example, showed up at the airport in Blanding when Secretary Zinke arrived. As well as this delegation of Utah officials arriving, the governor's plane included, legislative leadership, Representative Mike Noel, Senator David Hinkins. In some ways, this was kind of like a who's who of the land transfer movement in Utah, and they were accompanied. Secretary Zinke for much of his trip through Utah. So here his journey through our state, he is constantly hearing the case for getting rid of national monuments, changing the way federal land is managed to give more control to, or possibly outright ownership to, local and state governments.
Okay, Brian Maffley, public lands reporter. Hold that thought for just a moment. We do have a caller who's calling in to comment on this topic specifically. Bernadette from Rockville, you've got a comment about this story that we're covering.
Yes, I think to start with, a national monument has never been undone, so that makes it kind of a new precedent. And so I'd like to say see you in court, because I hope that it will not fly. And as an environmentalist and a proud environmentalist, I think it's so unfortunate, and I'm angry at our Utah delegation for being so anti-environment. It's old. It's earthworks, not too hot, not too cold, just the right amount of oxygen. So let's take care of it.
All right, Bernadette, thank you for your comment there. And Robert Gerke, you have a response there, is that right? No, I saw you grabbing your microphone.
Well,
right.
No, I think Bernadette will get her wish. I think this will end up in court one way or another, whether it's undone by the president, rescinded completely by President Trump, whether it's reduced by President Trump, it's going to end up going to court. And if it's not undone, I think you're going to see the other side sue over it, And so there's going to be litigation one way or another over this. The courts will end up deciding. The courts traditionally have upheld the monument designations and the president's discretion to designate them to the size and include what he wants and doesn't want. And so, you know, it is, as she mentioned, it would be unprecedented if President Trump does completely rescind the monument.
We should go to a break here in a moment, but what does rescinding look like? Since it hasn't been done in the past, is it just the president saying, I rescind this national monument?
Yeah. I think it would be pretty simple, frankly, because nothing has happened on the ground to change anything about the way the monument's managed right now. So it would just be a paperwork issue, really, more than anything, and it would stop the process of creating a monument management plan that could actually, you know, affect how the resources are governed. I think if I could opine here a little bit, because that's my job now. I mean, I think the tragedy of all of this is that there are a lot of archaeological resources out there that aren't being protected today, and nobody seems to be taking that seriously. There's been an increase in traffic there because of the tourism there, and so now we're debating over whether or not we're going to have a monument or not, and instead of talking about how we're actually going to protect the resources there on the ground, and that should be everybody's top priority, and nobody seems to give a darn about it.
You know, a narrative that some of those who are opposed to this monument have been sort of pushing is that American Indian proponents of the Bear's Ears designation have been exploited by environmentalists. Zinke, in an interview at the beginning of his trip here, said, you know, he disputed that. He said, no, that's not what's happening, which led to this kind of odd moment where Senator Orrin Hatch contradicted that statement, and he drew some criticism. And Brian Maffley, maybe you can tell us about what happened there if you were there to cover it.
Sure. Matt Piper was there to cover that, and he also is covering the Kanab end of the trip as well. So I don't know all the details there. Maybe Tommy Burr could address some of that.
We got Matt Cannon here. You can handle it.
Yeah, I pulled the story up to make it a little easier. So what we have here is we have Senator Orrin Hatch was asked by our reporter.
Sorry, we're changing mics. Give us a second, listeners. Okay, go ahead. He was asked by a reporter.
Senator Orrin Hatch was asked by reporters about this very topic, and what he said was, the Indians, this is a quote, the Indians, they don't fully understand that a lot of the things that they are currently take for granted on those lands, they won't be able to do if it's made clearly into a monument or a wilderness. So then he was asked to name what those would be, like what would be taken away. And he said that would take too much time. He was asked for one example. And he said, once you put a monument there, you do restrict a lot of things that could be done, and that includes use of the land. Just take my word for it. So he really didn't have an example, but we saw that there were Native American leaders in the state that asked for an apology after that.
Because the Indians just don't understand was sort of seen as a pretty insensitive tone-deaf comment by the senator, I think.
Brian Maffley, can I ask you on the point that Senator Hatch was making, things that people wouldn't be allowed to do? This is kind of we see this popping up every so often, the wood gathering or specific activities.
The specific activities people are worried about are the wood gathering. Which is allowed under permit and will continue to be allowed under permit, gathering medicinal herbs, ceremonial activities, grazing, obviously. Those things have all been called out in President Obama's proclamation as things that will continue to be allowed. Now how they're governed would be spelled out in whatever management plan comes out for the monument. Of course, local people would get to have a lot of say in that management plan. So I think Orrin Hatch has been hearing from some of the monument critics some misinformation. I'm not clear, what he's referring to. Yeah, you're not going to be able to go clear cut the pinyon juniper off the mountain, or the minerals have all been withdrawn. There won't be any oil and gas leasing.
Robert Kirky.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brian hit on it. But there's this sort of alarmism, I guess, or they're stoking this fear that they're going to be shut off of their traditional sacred lands, and there's no indication at all in anything that has been said or done heretofore that would be the case. I guess the big concern is whether they can drive their trucks up there to get the wood and so forth, and there is some question about travel across the land, and I guess maybe that's where this is coming from.
I have one sort of follow-up on this. Representative Rob Bishop, in congressional testimony earlier this month, this is something that Thomas Burr or you wrote about, he said that no local tribe in San Juan County, Utah, supported this designation. And I mean, that's another. We had somebody saying that environmentalists were manipulating indigenous groups, and now it's that they don't have the support.
Yeah.
Is that a true statement that there's no support on the ground, Brian Maffel?
Thomas.
Thomas, go ahead, Tommy.
Yeah, no problem. So look, I think half of San Juan County is are Navajo Navajos, and the Navajo Nation supports Bears Ears. It is true. I think there are five or six chapters, and there was one of them, the local chapter in San Juan County, that did not support the Bears Ears, but the nation as a whole did. And also, Brian can probably speak to this more, but five, six tribes in the region, plus another 20, 30 across the country, joined a letter to support Bears Ears.
Okay. You know, the comments by Hatch and Bishop are cases of people speaking for tribes, for Native Americans, who are people other than the tribes themselves. And just before we go to our break, Robert Gerke, to close this out, what should we make of the sort of tendency by Utah political leaders to make comments like that?
Well, I mean, they're kind of cherry picking. They couch it very narrowly. There's no tribe or no American Indian tribe in San Juan County. And so, as Tommy mentioned, the nation itself, the Navajo Nation as a whole, which when you think about it from the American Indian perspective, a county, an Anglo-dedicated county, doesn't really mean anything to them, right? They're a Navajo Nation. So we've got this one chapter, the Aneth chapter, that has opposed it. And so now they're cherry-picking that one chapter out of 110 chapters in the nation to say, you know, these guys have not endorsed it because they're split on it. But you do have also right smack dab in the middle of the Bears Ears Monument is the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. They support it. And you've got, as Brian has mentioned, these other tribes that have, so basically this comes down to they're cherry-picking their facts and trying to distort it to make it appear that there's this division or this dissent. And then stoking this fear again, as we mentioned, about whether they're going to continue to have access to it, and it's pretty damaging. It's galling, I think, as well, that so many of these, especially when you talk about the San Juan County commissioners, they haven't cared at all about the American Indians in their county for generations. You know, they've tried to minimize their ability to vote and have a say in the local politics. When there was this grave robbing, you know, these indictments several years ago, you saw many of these same people in San Juan County lining up to support the grave robbers who are now opposing the monument. And so it's pretty galling in that regard as well. So they suddenly care so much about the Navajo people.
I want to come back to that point, Brian Maffley, but I think we should go to our first break, and we'll stick with the story a little bit longer when we come back. Again, you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune on KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, public lands reporter Brian Maffley, senior managing editor Matt Canham, and columnist Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. And we are talking about this past week's local headlines. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. And before we left for the break, we were talking about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's visit to Utah this week as part of a review of national monuments, something that President Trump had asked for, kind of at the behest of Utah's delegation and Senator Orrin Hatch.
Yes. We've
been talking a lot about who he was with, Zinke, when he was there, and then later talking about not getting a hearing from the tribes. But there is, of course, opposition from members of the public in the region where the Bears Ears is as well, correct?
Yeah, there's plenty of that.
Yeah.
And that's no secret.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to just jump off there. But this is, again, talking about the rescinding of the National Monument, 111 years of history that's not been done, yet, ever. And so court battle could be looming, as we talked about. You know, I'm wondering, as Brian Maffley, as you traveled with Zinke, did you get the sense that his mind was already made up, or is there something that's, you know, could there be a wild card here, because he has 45 days to review Bear's ears, and why is it just 45 days for Bear's ears? Lots of questions I'm throwing at you.
Yeah. Well, Bear's ears has been fast tracked. The whole monument review thing is 120 days, so that's why we have such a narrow window for submitting public comment. Repeat the question again, Roger.
Yeah, sorry,
I kind of got lost.
The first aspect of that is, you know, do you have a sense that we know where this is going to go?
Yeah. Well, Secretary Zinke was very careful to not tip his hand. In fact, he said, you know, all the options are on the table as far as his recommendation goes, including enlarging these monuments. That's a bit of a unlikely scenario. So my feeling, however, is that he's kind of it seems like he has a mission, a marching orders. He's under an enormous amount of pressure from Utah state leaders to get rid of the Bear's Ears Monument and shrink the Grand Staircase, probably take out the Kaparowitz Plateau where there's 9 billion tons of recoverable high-quality coal. Hmm.
Yeah. And if I could just add, I mean, yeah, I think the whole fact that they're going through this, I think they made the decision, and then now they're going back to sort of justify the decision that they've already made. And so, you know, I think we kind of see which direction this is going. He did sort of tip his hand, I think, during one of his statements where he said that this area was protected before it was a monument and will be protected after it's a monument.
Yeah,
and that's sort of an indication that, like, hey, guess what? You know, this is not going to have that monument designation after we're done.
Well, my sense is when he said that, maybe, I don't know if he misspoke.
It may have been a misspeak, but it also...
But I think what he was also trying to get at is the Bear's Ears region will be... given some
protected
level of protection.
One way or another,
Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, you mentioned that. He had a brief, very brief visit there after the Bears, just a few hours. Does the fact that he was there for so short a period of time mean anything about you know, maybe him leaving Grand Staircase alone and focusing his attention just on the new monument?
Well, I think he just had so much time, Bears Ears was the priority. So what happened for Grand Staircase was he again his he was highly, you know, his time was highly managed. He was surrounded by this entourage of anti-monument, anti-public lands elected officials. You know, Mike Noel, for example, was a leading figure there. Matt Piper covered that end of it. One of the things that happened was there's a prominent business group, the Escalante Boulder Chamber of Commerce, which is unanimously supportive of leaving the monument the way it is, was denied any kind of opportunity to meet with Zinke. So the business community supporters did have a rally Wednesday afternoon in Kanab. Secretary Zinke kind of dismissively shrugged them off as you know, mere advocates, and if they want to comment, they can go online to regulation.gov and submit their comments that way.
Well, and that's part of a public comment period opening
today,
and people can contribute to that. But there's also been some criticism surrounding the online nature of the public comment period. Tell us about that.
So Senator Heinrich of New Mexico is really calling this out. He represents New Mexico, and many of his constituents are Native Americans who do not have internet access and really are being denied an opportunity to comment on the Bear's Ears monument review.
Kind of an odd question, but just thinking about the president's approval rating, it's at 36%, and we'll get to some of the reasons why that is the case in our next stories. But the turmoil ongoing at the White House, does that play into whether or not efforts to pursue challenging the Antiquities Act will be successful? I mean, it's kind of a hard one to answer. Anybody want to take a stab there?
Why don't we pitch that one to Tommy?
Tommy.
You know, thanks. I think we have to remember, 36% nationwide, but you want to drill down, and Trump supporters are still with him. And the people who voted for him are very much still backing what he does. And this is something that, you know, is a bone to, you know, red meat bone to to his supporters. And so, yeah, challenging the Antiquities Act is not going to change the opinion of liberals or even moderate and independent voters, but it might go away to, hey, I promised to do something, and I'm helping you coal miners and rural people, and they'll be supportive.
But in terms of, I guess, sort of a, you know, I don't know, the ability, if Congress, for example, has to weigh in on this, I guess they wouldn't. I mean, this is going to go to the courts, and that's the whole point. Robert Gerke, Congress.
Congress could weigh in on it. I mean, they could. That would actually be a preferable way for them to undo this monument, is for Congress to actually get off its butt and do something. If the president decides he's going to rescind it, yeah, it wouldn't necessarily take ratification by Congress to do it.
Okay, and it's, yeah. There are other stories that we've got to cover this week, but interesting coverage from Brian Maffley and the Salt Lake Tribune on the visit by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, whirlwind.
Well, thank you. I want to just correct one thing I said. I referred to Hank Stevens as chapter president of Old Jato. It's Navajo Mountain is his chapter.
Okay. And as I said, I want to turn to the other sort of big story of the week, one that's we've not been able to avoid, which is the president firing FBI Director James Comey. The reasons for that firing are a bit muddled because of the messaging that we've been getting coming out of the White House. But Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent, the timing of the firing was something that had a lot of people kind of scratching their heads. Maybe you can give us a quick recap of how this played out for anybody who has not been inundated or flooded with the news this week.
Let's just say it's been a little bit chaotic, including inside the White House.
And outside in the bushes of the White House, right? Sorry, we'll get
exactly.
to that.
No, I'm sorry, Spicer was among the bushes.
Among the bushes.
The Washington Post had to run a correction on its story because Spicer was mad about how they described him. So this came down, Tuesday around 5 o'clock. I was just walking out of the office and got the pull report from the White House, and I had to reread it three times because I couldn't believe this actually happened. And the explanation out of the White House changed several times, with it originally being, well, he did this recommendation of the Attorney General and the Deputy Director of the FBI, and that's why he had to fire him. And then Trump goes on NBC last night with Lester Holt and says, no, I was going to fire him no matter what the recommendation was, and very clearly stated that this was because of the Russia concerns, the investigation into whether there was collusion between the Trump team and Russia's meddling in the U.S. election, and tied it directly to that. It wasn't like, well, he's not doing a great job on other things. It was, I want this investigation to come to an end, and it's a made-up story, and I want to get rid of him. At one point, I think the president thought that he could get the FBI director to pledge his loyalty to him at a dinner at the White House, and the FBI director reportedly said, no, I'm not going to do that. But certainly caused a big stir here. Harkens back to the idea of Nixon firing the special prosecutor during Watergate, and it certainly is not going to end the Russia thing if that's what Trump was trying to do.
Well, and some people are calling for a special prosecutor or an independent investigator for a review of those contacts between the Trump presidential campaign and Russian officials during the election as a result of this firing. But I mean, they were calling for that beforehand as well. Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz, Tommy, also had some questions about how this firing happened, and he's asking for an investigation as well for the Department of Justice to look into this, right?
Yeah, so let's clarify exactly what he did, though, because I've heard a few people say, like, oh, he wants to investigate. And we're like, well, technically, Chaffetz could investigate on his own.
Right.
He has unilateral subpoena power. He could just go out and say, I want to know what happened, which is not what he did. But he did take a step. He asked the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, who's already looking into, this somewhat situation with Russia and meddling in the election, and where DOJ and FBI stood on that. And he asked them to expand the review to include the idea of what happened in this firing of Comey. So it is a step in the right direction, but it's a point where, it's Chaffetz not doing the investigation. He's asking somebody else to. And I should also just clarify, this is the Inspector General, as Gerke and Matt know from covering Washington. Inspector Generals do not report to the Attorney General. They're a separate kind of outside auditor kind of thing where they can do their own investigations without having to worry about their jobs.
But it's also the Inspector General does not have the same sort of subpoena power that Chaffetz would have as the oversight chairman. So it is less tools that this investigator could actually deploy It's kind of hard to see how an inspector general of the Justice Department is really going to get into the White House and the idea of what the White House did. That's a pretty hard reach, and it's just one layer of many investigations going on. But there, as you said, there are people who have asked for different levels of investigation.
And this, sorry, just to clarify, this is a level of investigation that might not be able to get very far.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. With the White House, it will be hard for an inspector general to get
The White House can easily stonewall the Inspector General from the Justice Department, but it would have a much harder time stonewalling the chairman of the House Oversight Committee if the House Oversight Committee actually was willing to step forward and take charge of this. I know he's still really busy with investigating Hillary Clinton's emails, but it's sort of confounding that he takes this sort of half measure. And I realize he's on his way out, perhaps, as chairman, and he's not maybe doesn't want to start an investigation. He's not going to be there to see through, but to do this and then like pretend that this is somehow a significant step. I mean, the inspector general can do what the inspector general wants to do. He doesn't need a request from Jason Chaffetz to do it. But the House Oversight Committee, which has a lot more power, a lot more reach, and a lot more authority, could have actually taken a positive step on this, and they just decided not to.
Robert Gerke, the columnist there. How does this compare what Chaffetz asked for, which is, you know, this investigation by the inspector general, however thorough it could be, to what the rest of the Utah delegation said? And maybe that's a question for Tommy.
Yeah, he was the only one in the delegation actually to speak out about actually want some kind of investigation into the firing of James Comey. Hatch and Lee both said they would have handled it differently, questioned the timing a little bit, but both had lost confidence in Comey and are looking for a fresh start at the FBI. We got a very kind of strange comment from Representative Chris Stewart, which is almost like a sympathy card, kind of get well soon. Pretty much like, you know, I have great respect for him and I wish him well. That's all he said.
And Chris Stewart is a member of the House Intelligence Committee that's conducting this, one of the committees that's conducting this Russia investigation. And he did say that he would be open to considering the possibility of independent investigation. Because I think where we are now is very difficult for the sitting president, who at least his associates are under investigation, to pick the guy who's going to lead that investigation and do it with any sense of that there's going to be a credible investigation conducted. And then you've got Senator Lee and Senator Hatch, who are both on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who are going to be responsible for confirming the replacement. Are they going to demand that, you know, somebody who has independence, or are they just going to fall in line with Trump again like they have so far? And so, you know, to have this sort of charade that, you know, over the next several weeks about, you know, trotting somebody out in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee who's, you know, it just seems like from the public standpoint, there's not any reason for them to have any confidence that this thing's going to be conducted with integrity.
Well, Senator Lee had a suggestion on who Trump might consider replacing Comey with. I am assuming that was a serious suggestion, and Merrick Garland.
Tommy, you want to
take that one? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think this is one where you have to read between the lines a little bit here, too. So Senator Lee tweeted yesterday that perhaps the president should pick Merrick Garland, who was Obama's pick to join the Supreme Court, and the Republicans refused to even, you know, consider that nomination. And now Mike Lee's saying, well, why don't you choose Merrick Garland as the new FBI director? There's a couple of questions about that, because Mike Lee is very critical of Merrick Garland as a liberal Democrat last year. Two, there's some who see this as a ploy to try to get Merrick Garland, who is the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the second most powerful court in the nation, to get him off the court so that Trump could appoint his own more conservative judge to that court. It is something that Mike Lee pitched to the White House. Don't really know. I heard a bit of a mixed reaction idea, but he did actually meet with people at the White House and suggest the idea. Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota, initially was like, oh, that's a great idea, and then clarified that, you know, she was more happy to have people suggesting consensus picks.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the Merrick Garland pick would do away with the whole inconvenience of having to have confirmation hearings, because he would never get a confirmation hearing from the Senate Judiciary Committee, and, given his track record. But given the alternatives as well, I mean, we're hearing names like Chris Christie, Trey Gowdy, a congressman who's a devout Trump loyalist, is that name surfaced, and so maybe Merrick Garland wouldn't be such a bad idea given the company.
Guys, hold that thought. You're going to have to take another quick break here on the program, and we will stick with this story: the firing of FBI Director James Comey and the response from our delegation in Washington and beyond. But let's do take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions about this week's news by calling 801-355-TALK, or you can comment at sltrib.com. We've been talking about the dismissal by President Trump of FBI Director James Comey. We heard a little bit about how Utah's delegation has reacted, and Jason Chaffetz asking for a sort of very specific investigation of this. But have other Republicans in Congress, and Matt Canham, this might be a question for you, have other Republicans in Congress asked for some kind of investigation into how this the ties between the Trump administration and Russia and election hacking, that sort of thing?
Senator John McCain, before all of this, had called for a select committee of Congress, which has happened in the past a few times, where they get a group that just looks laser focused on one issue, and he's asked for that for a while now, and he reiterated that after this. The only other movement I am aware of is Justin Amash in the House has signed on to a bill to ask for a special prosecutor, and he's the only Republican I'm aware of who has taken that step. We've seen a lot since the Comey firing of Republicans being concerned about the timing, which is what we heard from some Utahns. We're concerned about what happened here. You had someone like Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, who has kind of a track record of being a little independent. He was kind of critical. You saw Richard Burr, the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, say he was critical of it. But they stopped short of taking that next step.
Tommy Burr, when we're talking about Russian election hacking or the Trump campaign and Russia connections, I think there are some people in our country who are seeing, Manchurian candidate kind of stuff going on here. Is that where we are? What do we actually know so far?
What do we know? That's a good question. So first off, I would want to add to what Matt was saying, that right now there is no law to allow a special prosecutor to be appointed. So Congress would actually have because that act expired. So Congress would actually have to pass something to allow a special prosecutor. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has already said that's not going to happen. So the Select Committee may be the only thing that could happen through this Congress if we have enough. Look, I think there's a lot of questions that we just really don't know because of some of the secrecy in the White House. The president's not releasing his tax returns. We don't know what kind of investments he might have. They did just release a tax letter that shows that he made, millions of dollars off of a sale of a house with involving Russians and a few other things. This White House did something this week that is just kind of shocking. The day after firing James Comey, the president meets with the foreign minister of Russia and the ambassador from Russia in the Oval Office, does not allow the press inside, but allows a Russian news agency photographer in to photograph the meeting. So we American reporters couldn't go in, but the Russian state-owned media could go in, and they released a photo. These all just kind of add up to a heck of a lot of smoke.
There was also a kind of weird turn this morning, Tommy, when Trump issued a sort of veiled threat to Comey, who he fired, and made some comments about press briefings as well, all of this via tweet. What did he say?
Yeah, this was a very interesting and raised, again, more questions than it answered when Trump pretty much threatened Comey that he better not have any, quote, tapes of their conversation. And the White House is not saying now whether Trump actually records his conversations in the Oval Office like, you know, President Nixon did. And that didn't work out very well for Nixon, by the way. Or if Comey maybe was smart enough to record his conversations to make sure that he had proof going forward that he, for example, may not have told the president he wasn't under investigation. But it was a veiled threat to the former FBI director to say, you better not have anything like that.
And he also kind of suggested that the press has this all wrong. And so he again threatened to essentially cut off press briefings. Is that right?
So this may be one of those great distractions that the president's good at doing to, you know, get reporters off the other story to be focusing on themselves. And in one tweet, though, he said, well, maybe we shouldn't do press briefings because it can't always be accurate from the podium, but we can issue written handout documents, which is so, you know, 1990. But let's also point out that the White House statement on Tuesday evening was also wrong. The one they put out on paper was actually wrong from the account the president gave.
I want to bring in Robert Gerke, Tribune columnist. The turmoil surrounding the firing, is it bad optics? Is it what is it more? It's got to be more than that. I mean, tell us what your opinion is as a columnist.
You know, I guess I fall somewhere. I mean, there are people who are demanding impeachment hearings and saying this is a constitutional crisis. I think it is. Pretty astonishing. I think one of the more entertaining bits of it was when the Nixon Library tweeted that Richard Nixon had never actually fired a FBI director. It's like even the Nixon supporters are saying, "Hey, Nixon didn't do this." So it's unprecedented. It's astonishing, really, that, you know, to even think that. The FBI is supposed to have some independence. They're supposed to investigate and let the facts take them where they may. And for the president to interfere this brazenly with an ongoing investigation, and then for his staff to try to paper over it with some trumped up, so to speak, you know, the blaming it on the way the Hillary thing was handled. Now, look, I mean, Comey botched the Hillary investigation last year. I mean, not filing charges, and we're gonna, you know, we're reopening it right before the election, and that whole thing was poorly handled. And I think he maybe acknowledges that to some degree, says he would do it, would have done it the same. But, you know, it was poorly handled. There were reasons, and there were Democrats who were saying that he should be let go. But I think to do it in the way they did it, and to have such a sloppy kind of response to it, is pretty stunning. Now, look, Bill Clinton fired a FBI director back in, I think, 95, I believe it was. But, you know, this was the culmination of a six-month-long process, and they had somebody else lined up to replace him, and it was, you know, so it was just handled in a much different way. You know, there's still a lot of other unanswered questions, I think, about this, and there is going to be – the dust hasn't settled on this by a long shot. Hmm.
Well, it's a story that seems to be kind of enveloping everything in the news cycle. But just for – we have a couple of minutes before we have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, and I'd like to actually pivot back to another topic that had been at the forefront of the news, and this is the Republican health care bill that passed through the House and is, I think, awaiting Senate debate. It's the repeal and replace Obamacare effort. And Thomas Burr, we talked about some comments from Senator Orrin Hatch on Native Americans earlier in the show that drew some fire. Senator Hatch also said something this week on the health care debate that riled up a few people. What did he say?
Yeah, that was very interesting for Hatch to make this comment. I mean, he was essentially asked, he's part of a 13-member group of the Senate that's working on pretty much redrafting the entire legislation because they don't want to take up what the House passed. And he's leaving one of these meetings, and he's asked by reporters, you know, what are the challenges, essentially, are you facing in drafting a bill? And his comment was, well, the public wants every dime they can be given. And essentially, they don't. Let me pull it up so I can read it exactly. The public wants every dime they can be given. Let's face it, once you get them on the dole, they'll take every dime they can. We've got to find some way of getting things under control, or this country and your future is going to be gone. That's kind of shocking to some people who say that I want health care. I don't want to be in the government dole. I want to be able to have health care for my family. So, you know, upsetting. Hatch makes these comments on occasion, and then, you know, the office walks him back a little bit. But it was something that I'm sure he probably wishes he could take back.
Well, it seems on the other side of that, it seems that there's a case for that, that the fact that Obamacare is now the law of the land makes it difficult to strip away because people are benefiting from the health care that it offers.
Yeah, in fact, I think it was Senator Manchin who said this after the GOP vote in the House to pass the repeal and replace, that people may not attribute Obamacare to getting their health care, but they'll know who took it away. And it is something that's very difficult in this country, from anything from Social Security to making changes to Medicaid. The idea of taking something like that back really upsets people.
Okay. Guys, I'm sorry, we've reached just the end of the show, and we've got to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week, just like that. And Tommy, are you ready with an underplayed story?
Sure, I'll just go on the tax letter that the White House just released. It's a two-month-old letter from some lawyers for President Trump who say that he doesn't have any Russia investments or dealings except for a few exceptions, and they go through several of them. It's something that we'll see how that plays out right now, but I should note that the firm that put out the letter was the 2016 Russia Law Firm of the Year, not making that up.
Wow. That's an interesting underplayed story. How about yourself, Matt Canham? Have you got one?
Yes, I'll go more local with the company that owns Channel 2, KUTV, bought the company that owns Channel 13 in Utah, right, which creates an interesting scenario where they either are going to have to sell Channel 13 or figure out if they can get some loophole where they can own two of the big four stations locally.
Sinclair Media Group is
there. Yeah.
Okay.
Something to keep an eye on.
All right. Matt Canham's underplayed story. Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, this one actually just happened yesterday. It got quite a bit of attention, actually some national attention, but I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, and that is the LDS Church breaking its longstanding relationship with the Boy Scouts of America for the older 14 to 18 group. And it's significant because the LDS Church was such a huge supporter of scouting across the country, made up, I think it was 130,000 Boy Scouts in that age division. And so while the announcement came yesterday, I think we need to see how this sort of unfolds and plays out, because I think it could have some dramatic impacts on scouts nationwide.
They say it's not about the decision by the scouts to allow gay scout leaders.
They did, yes.
Okay. Brian Maffley, your underplayed story.
Yeah, I've just been watching this deepening rift between the University of Utah and the Huntsman Cancer Institute. It kind of got even deeper this week with a full-page ad. I didn't actually see the ad. I haven't seen the paper because I've been on the road a lot. Taken out by John Huntsman Sr., essentially accusing the university of stiffing the institute for $50 million in operating expenses. And it just seems to be getting stranger and stranger.
That's okay. An underplayed story from Brian Maffley. For my part, I'm going to say this premise is a bar, not a restaurant. This premise is a restaurant, not a bar. That's at the front of any establishment that serves hard alcohol here in Utah, thanks to state law now. You can find that Trib Food and Alcohol story by Kathy Stevenson at sltrib.com. I want to thank Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and today he's talking about his Wikipedia profile. Robert Kirby, in March, when State Representative Mike Winder, he was formerly the mayor of West Valley City, was accused of sort of bolstering or favorably editing his Wikipedia profile, you decided to check on your own online biography, and so you the first thing you did was you Googled Robert Kirby moron.
Yeah, and I was the third entry on the list.
All right. Well, you found a Wikipedia page and decided that it could use some sprucing up. And so in a column, you added some edits here and there because it just didn't paint the right picture the way that it was laid out on
That's
Wikipedia.
That's correct.
Would you mind giving us a taste of some of your editorial fixes? I know that there's, the very first line is that you're a newspaper columnist. Maybe you could read us that part.
Well, I first started writing columns down in Utah County. Back when I was still a police officer. And one of the columns that I wanted to write was what cops really do, what cops are really like, and what they really think about the people that they're supposed to protect and that sort of thing. And so I invented a character, a police officer, John Krieg. His nickname was Blitz, Blitzkrieg.
Right.
And they liked it, and so they started running it. And I would explain why cops check out people who are parked in the dark and the sort of things that police officers look for.
Right.
The initial outrage over it came from several police administrators who said that the person writing this hot column could not be a real cop, probably because I was rude in it. And then another wave of outrage came when people who were familiar with history understand that Blitzkrieg was a form of German warfare in World War II.
And they were not happy with that reference.
No, they weren't.
I like, there's this, Robert Kirby, born 1953 in California, is an American writer, and then your edition, Of Sorts.
Of Sorts, that's correct. Sometimes the idea that if you're a writer, you're serious.
You also say, Kirby is a popular convention speaker and travels, this isn't you, this is the Wikipedia entry. Kirby is a popular convention speaker and travels widely to appear at conventions and meetings, and then your edition is, but is rarely invited back.
I think they've booked me only because they can't have strippers anymore.
At the conventions.
Yeah.
In 1989, Kirby decided to leave police work and devote himself to full-time writing, Kirby's edition here, and prude baiting. This is the idea that people get their feathers ruffled by what you write.
That's intentional. I mean, there's no, someone once said, I forget who, that there's no point in writing unless you make some people mad. And it's easy to do in places where people take themselves too seriously. Now, this can be a church thing or a political thing or whatever, because I get, you know, I draw fire from all sorts of groups.
Totally detouring from the original topic of this conversation, but is your intention to do that? I mean, to ruffle feathers, and do you have a particular audience in mind who you're targeting that towards?
Yeah, I do. Something along that line would be the irony between the way citizens recently in Draper recently behaved regarding a homeless shelter that was being considered for their community, and the conference, the LDS conference speakers suggesting that we be accepting of people who are unfortunate or
discrepancy.
In need. Right. And so I'm always on the look for irony in the way that people behave.
And Utah, I think you've written, is a place that's ripe for that.
Yes, right. Yeah. You have a large group of people who behave alike and look alike and believe alike.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby talking about pushing people's buttons to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for joining us, and have a great weekend.